Isabella Tree is an author and travel writer. Her award-winning book, Wilding, The Return of Nature to a British Farm, describes how she and her conservationist husband, Charlie, decided after many generations of intensive dairy and arable farming to undertake a pioneering experiment. They would rewild their 3,500-acre estate, Knepp, in West Sussex, returning it to nature. Using herds of free-roaming animals to create new habitats, their rewilded land is now, more than 20 years later, a haven for wildlife and rare species like turtle doves, nightingales, and purple emperor butterflies. The estate has become central to the debate about how we look after and regenerate the land. Isabella is also a travel journalist and has written books about her journeys to Nepal, Mexico, and Papua New Guinea. We're going to hear Music, Isabella, by Schubert, Handel and Bach. Some fairly seminal pieces, actually. And the first piece is by Chopin, not a solo piece, though.
Well, Chopin is something that my parents weren't ever very into classical music. My father was passionate about trad jazz, so we grew up with Billie Holiday and Jack Teagarden and Louis Armstrong. But he did play Chopin, and quite often early in the mornings. So for me, this is just the most beautiful early morning piece that resonates today.
But did he play it on a record? Or
yes,
did he play
on
the
a record.
Piano?
Yeah. The beginning of the record would always jump because he smoked a pipe, and the dribble from his pipe would always land on track number one when he put the record on.
That's taking rewilding a bit far.
It is a bit.
Thank you.
I was imagining you listening to that almost bird-like music, actually. Do you agree?
Absolutely. There is very much a dawn chorus about it, isn't there? Mm. And no, it's my father standing at his easel, puffing away on his pipe, painting, and all is good with the world. Wonderful.
As played beautifully by Murray Pariah there, with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Zubin Mehta, the first movement of Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 1 in E minor. Isabella, you were actually adopted at a very young age, weren't you?
Yes, I mean, I was 6 weeks old, I think. Yes, so very young.
And did you know later that that was the case?
Yes, I never knew when I'd been made aware of it. I think that was what was so clever about my parents, that we always knew we'd been adopted. And the way they phrased it to us was that, you know, they'd chosen us, which was very clever of them, I think.
When you say us?
My sister and I. Yeah. She's 2 years younger than me, so she was adopted 2 years after me.
Your mother, Lady Antrey, was a remarkable woman, actually, a philanthropist and campaigner. She once wrote a letter to the Home Secretary saying, "Shits like you that bring this country down," so quite direct.
She was very direct, and I think she just lost her temper with asking for something very reasonable of the government, which is that prisoners inside prison, making things absolutely stunning and beautiful, should be allowed to earn some money from it to give them self-respect, but also to give to their families and to give them a little bit of a buffer for when they left prison, because they have nothing. Her impassioned letters were met again and again with silence by the Home Secretary, so she sent this humdinger of a letter, which was then eventually pinned on the wall because it was so funny.
What, in the Home Office?
In the Home Office, and eventually it did the trick.
You had a lot of wonderful influences from your parents, because your father, Michael Tree, was director of Christie's and also Colfax and Fowler, the interior decorating firm. So sort of visual images must have been entering your life at that time, as well as musical ones.
Absolutely. I think they were obviously very excited by art. You know, we went to exhibitions often with them, but my father's wonderful method of introducing young children to art was we would go and see one painting and look at it for 5 or 10 minutes, or however long you wanted to, and then go and have a fantastic lunch. And that way you do really remember that painting.
You had also a very free childhood, because your mum would take you on incredible journeys to places like the Himalayas.
She was a passionate traveller. She travelled with carpet bags, nothing with wheels, you know. It was really impractical. But she loved adventure. And one of the earliest trips we went on was to Kashmir and Ladakh. The first year Ladakh was open to tourists, actually, before the airport was ever built. And it was magical. That sort of kicked off, I think, my obsession with the Himalayas.
You were sent to convent school, and I can't help whether you conformed to the usual image of convent school girls being actually very rebellious.
I'm afraid I was. I mean, I'm Church of England, and I was there as a day girl, and I'm afraid I must have been an absolute pain in the neck. I mean, I was signing the cross upside down, dipping my left hand into the holy water. I mean, anything to rile the nuns, I think. And I started an alternative religion in the woods, a sort of pagan religion. So I think I made their lives a nightmare. But it was strange upbringing, actually, I think, for children.
I hope they put
children.
It down to doing penance of some sort.
Yes, maybe they did.
And I think this next piece was something you heard when you were quite young.
This was the first real live concert I ever went to. A friend of mine, Rafe, when we were still teenagers, he took me to Handel's Messiah and this most amazing performance in the Baroque 18th century chapel at Warder Castle. And we sat in the choir, looking down on the congregation and the singers in front of the altar. And I remember just being completely blown away by it. And obviously there's lots of wonderful, joyous music in it, but the section that really moved me was "He Was Despised." And I think I was at the time battling with my ideas of what religion and Christianity were all about and rebelling against the convent and the nuns. But this piece just made me realise that the heart of Christianity, I think, is this amazing love and compassion in the face of intolerance, hatred, violence, and it so overwhelmingly moves you to pity. I think it's extraordinary.
Especially as sung here by Alice Coote. Thank you. I was thinking as we were listening to that Isabella Tree that in a way it could easily relate to the work your mother was doing in prisons.
Absolutely, and she really had, I think, astonishing compassion for the underdog, as she put it, for people who society often forget or neglect.
He was despised, the aria from Handel's Messiah. We heard there Alice Coote with the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by the late much missed Stephen Clebury. Your husband inherited the estate, as I said, at Knepp in 1987, from his grandparents, in fact. What was it like when you first arrived?
Well, Charlie and I have been together forever. He reminded me the other day it was about 42 years. So I've been living at Knepp, really, since I was 18. And the house itself hadn't changed since the Second World War, so the kind of blackout blinds and electric switches that would throw you backwards off your feet if you turn the lights on. And the land was ploughed, all of it, every inch had been ploughed up since the Second World War, and they just continued in that vein, digging for victory. So it was arable and dairy. We thought that was normal. We used to go to the ends of the earth. I was a travel writer, to see wonderful wildlife. We would campaign against felling the rainforest, but we'd never think really about what we were doing to the land itself at home, that we were responsible for these huge declines in wildlife back in England. And I think it was only really when Charlie made the big decision to give up farming. We're on very poor soil, very, very heavy clay, 320 metres of clay. It was never profitable for farming. And after 17 years of trying, we were £1.5 million in debt, and he decided to change tack and do something with the land rather than battling against it all the time, and to try this experiment in rewilding instead.
It has caused a lot of comment, hasn't it? And also set an example for what can be done. How did you go about it?
We did it in stages. We weren't brave enough to suddenly have an epiphany and say, let's turn the whole estate over to rewilding. Ultimately, what we've done is ring-fence the whole 3,500 acres, allow vegetation to recover in the exposed arable fields after their last harvest. And as the hawthorn and blackthorn comes back, then they become the natural nurseries for regenerating saplings of oak and crabapple and wild service and all sorts of wonderful trees. And then at some point you want to introduce the free-roaming herbivores to mimic the great herds of animals that would have roamed our landscape before human impact. So the aurochs and the tarpan and the great herds of elk and bison and beavers and everything that would have been here interacting with our vegetation. And so you introduce these animals in small numbers and you watch this incredible mosaic of different habitats, very complex kaleidoscope of habitats emerging. And it came to life so quickly. I mean, that first summer, just hearing the insects once the wildflowers began to come back. And then, of course, with the insects came the birds. It was a sound that you hadn't realised as farmers that you were missing.
I dare say some of your neighbours were less keen to see the other side of the fence, thistles and ragwort blossoming.
We had, in the early days, there was a lot of, yes, thistle and ragwort and your sincerely disgusted letters coming our way. Mm. And that's kind of understandable. You know, you've retired to the countryside, you've bought your idyllic cottage, looking over to the downs, over managed, immaculate farmland, and suddenly your neighbour is turning into docks and thistles and ragwort and hiding your view of the downs.
Because ragwort, of course, is poisonous, actually, to a lot of animals.
It is poisonous to animals if they eat it,
yeah.
But in the wild they won't. Mm. So horses know not to touch it. They've co-evolved with ragwort. It's our native wildflower, hugely important for pollinating insects and nighttime moths, which are our best pollinating insects. The problem is when it's cut into hay, that's when animals can't recognise it anymore. So you definitely don't want it in hay meadows. Mm. But otherwise, in the wild, it's a really important species.
Quite yeah. pretty, too.
And beautiful,
yellow
if
flowers.
You can shed your preconceptions about it, yeah.
Mm. Well, from a pastoral idyll to a musical one, because your next music is Mozart, isn't it?
It is, and my great friend Patrick Kiernan, I went to school with, he's a violinist. It was really through him that I met Charlie, who'd already left the school, but had kept this gang of friends there. And Patrick started up the Brindisi String Quartet. So Charlie and I would go religiously to every concert. And this was one of the pieces that they always played. And for us, when we were going through the real torment of a failing farm, even whether we should even leave, and trying to pull a house that hadn't been touched since the Second World War into the 20th century, and two small children, there were many, many sleepless nights, and we would always listen to this.
Thank you.
part of the fourth movement of Mozart's Clarinet Quintet in A major, played by Nicholas Carpenter and the Brindisi String Quartet. It's more than 20 years now since you and Charlie decided to rewild NEP. Is it, with the grants that are now becoming available, financially viable to do what you've done on a wider scale, do you think?
It definitely is. I mean, we were losing money farming, so for us that was just a huge relief to draw a line underneath that sort of hemorrhaging of costs. The problem, I think, is transitioning into another system of land management. So I think it's important for the government to recognise that if you're going to appreciate nature restoration and carbon sequestration and flood mitigation, all the other kind of public goods that we need from the land, apart from food, then those need to be paid for. But what happens once a rewilding project is established is that suddenly all these, which we hadn't expected, all these income streams become available to you. So we now have an ecotourism business that turns over about $1 million a year. That makes a 20% margin, which is way more than anything we could have hoped for with farming. That's safaris and glamping and camping. And then all those farm buildings that just cost an arm and a leg to keep the roof on, you can convert into office space, light industrial use, storage. And those buildings now on NEP, the companies that rent them from us, employ 200 people. So that's 200 people back in a rural environment. And then we sell our meat. So we keep the animal densities low because we don't have apex predators. We are the wolf, we're the lynx. Sales go through online and direct to the consumer. And that's really a significant income stream for us.
How do you answer those scientists who say the world population is expanding, we need to use every inch to grow food?
Well, we already grow enough food for between 10 and 11 billion people, according to which statistics you're looking at. And we are now 8 billion now. So we're overproducing food. We waste 30 to 40% of it. And that is something that's never addressed in these conversations about food security. We've got to shift to regenerative agriculture. We cannot continue ploughing because we're losing topsoil. Soon we'll have no topsoil left in which to grow anything. And we are running out of water, so we can't carry on irrigating crops. We've got to work with nature. That is true food security. That's going to provide us with food for the future. We know that if you leave margins for nature around fields, that actually increases your crop yields without any other inputs. Where rewilding, I think, comes in is it provides that life support system for farming. So it can provide the pollinating insects for the crops. It can provide the natural predators to eat the aphids and the other diseases and pests that are going to attack your crops. It can restore the water tables. It can clean water. It can provide the buffers, the microclimates, to protect the conditions that those crops need to grow.
Do you have any particular favourite flora or fauna that have come back?
I know we're coming up to a turtle dove, but it is my favourite. I mean, because when I was growing up in the 1960s, there were 250,000 turtle doves. To me, that was the sound of summer. You know, that lovely tour, tour that you hear in the hedgerows. And we're losing it. The RSPB reckons probably in about 10 to 15 years, it will be gone. And suddenly, about 5 or 6 years into the rewilding project, we heard a turtle dove at NEP. And we thought, it's a one-off. It's been blown off course. But year by year, those numbers have grown. So now, on a summer's evening, you can go out and you can be pretty sure of hearing that lovely tour, tour from the bushes, or even see one on the withered bough, as Shakespeare puts it. They love territorially declaring their position on a withered bough of an oak tree.
Tell me about Sam Lee's turtle dove, which we're going to hear.
Oh, Sam Lee is amazing, and he started coming to us when our nightingales came back, and he would sing in duet with the nightingales. And then when our turtle doves came back, he made the connection with Vaughan Williams, who recorded a landlord in the Plough Inn in Rusper, which is about 10 miles away from us, this version of the turtle dove song. And so Sam started singing this song in his inimitable way. But what he also started doing was a pilgrimage, taking people from the Plough Inn in Rusper and then walking, bivouacking on the way in a churchyard or something, and then arriving at NEP at dawn so that he and his posse of pilgrims can listen to a turtle dove in the flesh.
Oh, can't you see the little turtle dove sitting under the mulberry tree. See how that she does mourn for true love, as I shall mourn for thee, my love, as I shall mourn for thee. Oh, fare thee well, my little turtle dove, and fare thee well for a while. For though you go, you'll surely return, if you go 10,000 miles, my love. If you go 10,000 miles, 10,000 miles is very far away for you to return to me. You'll leave me here to lament and wail a day, my dear. My little turtle dove, she'll change its color white. If I prove false to the songbird that I love, the noonday shall sound as night, my love. The noonday shall sound as night.
Turtle Dove by Sam Lee, the song originally collected in 1903 by Vaughan Williams. Isabella Treat, do you think that the travel writer that you've become was very much instigated by those early trips with your mother?
Absolutely. It gave me a permanently itchy feet, I think, longing to explore new places.
Well, I was going to say that you often visit indigenous people and try to get to the root of their traditions and customs.
I've always been fascinated by that, and I think, again, in another life I might have been an anthropologist.
Well, I think you are one, in a way.
You know, we have so much to learn from indigenous people, particularly now, you know, when we're trying to work out how to save the planet. You know, there are civilizations that have been living in coexistence with nature for thousands and thousands of years, very happily, and we need to learn from them how to do it.
One of your books is about Nepal and the tradition of the living goddess. Tell us about her.
It's a fascinating story. She's a child goddess, pretty much like the Dalai Lama, chosen as a child. She has to have 32 perfections. Voice like a duck, legs like a banyan tree. They find them. And she's enthroned as the embodiment of the omnipotent mother goddess. So it's one of the last places in the world where the omniscient deity is female. And for me, that's very exciting, especially having grown up in the convent with a very patriarchal view of religion. I originally started writing the book feeling that there might be something a little awkward about taking a child away from her parents and enthroning her in a palace. But actually, the more I researched it, and I went into an amazing sort of vortex with this book for about 14 years, it came to me that this was a really religious devotion. And several living goddesses have now become friends of mine, ex-living goddesses. When they reach puberty, they are returned to their families and live a normal life. Many of them have gone on to master students in business studies, to start up their own software companies. They're amazing, amazing women. And I've asked all of them, would you do the same? Would you ever offer your daughter to be a living goddess? And they've all said yes.
And you go back to Nepal every 5 years or so?
Yeah, so I touch base with the Kumaris, they're called, and their caretakers every 5 years or so and went back actually with a group of friends last November and had the most amazing trip.
And you've actually got some music to conjure that up. I think it's nuns chanting.
It is. We went to a monastery and nunnery combined in eastern Nepal, and I'd never heard nuns chanting before. I think people are more familiar with the sort of guttural throat chanting of the monks with those long horns and cymbals and drums. And it was a complete revelation listening to these nuns. To me, it sounds like being in a beehive, and it's got that all-enveloping kind of sonic vibration that pulls you in.
Nuns chanting, it does have a sort of bee-like quality to it.
It's mesmeric, isn't it? And I think you need to be in one of those wonderful, huge, painted Tibetan halls and just be sitting there on your cushion for 3 hours and you go into this extraordinary state. It's quite difficult to listen to on a short burst like that.
Well, as we've heard, bird life is thriving at Nep. Turtle doves, skylarks have returned. But your next piece of music was inspired by white storks returning and breeding.
It's extraordinary what's happened with Nep, because I think it inspires people in so many different ways, and one of them is music. And Helen Ottaway has created this incredible tribute to the white stork. So the last white storks that nested in Britain was 1416 on St Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh. So we've been missing them for 600 years in Britain.
And they're different from the storks we normally see, in what way?
They are the white storks that you'll see in Europe with those big shaggy nests on top of churches.
Yeah.
That's them. Mm. They disappeared quite early in sort of like 12th, 13th century, so it's very difficult to find evidence of them. But they're in medieval banquets on the menu, so it looks like we did eat them, literally out of house and home. They were also associated with rebellion, so monarchies didn't like them because they thought that white storks might foment peasant revolts. So they might have been persecuted simply because of that association. They're a bird that won't recolonise Britain naturally because they need to have an established colony in order to attract wild birds from Europe. We imported birds from Poland, injured birds that were given to us by Warsaw Zoo. They'd been hit by cars or had collisions in pylons. So they're non-flying birds. So they form our colony. And then they attracted these wild birds. So in the first summer of lockdown were the first free-flying white storks to nest again in Britain in the tops of Nep oak trees. So Helen wrote this piece to celebrate that. And it's wonderful. It's a story. It's the birds flying over to Britain, finding Nep, finding a place to nest, and they pair up. So a lot of the musicians play in pairs in this piece and make their nests. They do this amazing bill clattering to bond with each other. They throw their necks back and clatter their bills. And that resonates through the tapping of the bows on the instruments. And then finally they fledge and then they fly back to Africa, go back on migration.
Thank you. The final part of the White Storks String Octet by Helen Ottaway, performed at NEP during lockdown in July 2020 by members of the Bernardi Music Group. And I think we're even going to have, by contrast to a stork, a big fat earthworm.
Yes, extraordinary. Richard Durrant, who's an amazing musician, he has a guitar made of bog oak, so one of those 5,000-year-old trees that's been excavated by farmers ploughing in East Anglia. And it makes this incredible sort of resonant sound. But he, during lockdown, produced an album called Rewilding. And the first side of the album is everything from aurochs and the life above ground. And the flip side of the album is underground and this amazing piece with an earthworm. And you can hear all the busyness of life, all that soil biota going about its work. And then the earthworm, like a sort of huge pneumatic pressure pushing the earth through itself. And I think he uses a kind of contrabassoon, I think, in there somewhere to make that huge heavy noise of the tiniest invertebrate. But it's so powerful. I absolutely love it. He's like the kind of Jacques Cousteau of the soil world, Richard Durrant.
Let's just hear a quick bit of it. Earthworm by Richard Durrant. Well, from almost the ridiculous to the sublime, because you've chosen part of the Trout Quintet by Schubert next, Isabella Tree.
Yes, this is something that Andrew Bernardi, who founded the Bernardi Music Group, every year he holds a Wilding concert at NEP. And this is quite often a piece that he'll play. And I absolutely love it. But what I feel now is that, you know, when we listen to these beautiful pieces of music, you're hearing in your mind's eye a landscape that is gone, and we don't know that it's gone often. You know, most people listening to Lark Ascending, for example, will never have heard a skylark. And the same thing here with the trout. You know, you're imagining these wonderful, fast-flowing, crystal-clear streams and trout wriggling their way up the streams. And that is not happening anymore. You know, we have the most polluted rivers in Europe. And since we took out 3 weirs and 2 other big blockages across the river at NEP, we now have sea trout migrating up the river. We've just found a huge sea trout in our beaver pen.
Well, so, I think the beavers are quite happy to see it, aren't they?
Oh, the beavers will be very happy to see it. I mean, they're obviously vegetarians. They're not going to, you know, harm the fish. Mm. But, you know, it's so interesting that in our efforts to try and bring back beavers, as long as we're still insisting on keeping them in pens, we're actually creating another blockage for the migrating fish. So when I listen to this, I'm picturing what I hope will be the wonderful free-flowing rivers of the future.
The final part of the fourth movement of the Trout Quintet by Schubert, performed by the Melos Ensemble of London. Isabella Tree, do you think that other farmers will be able to pick up what you started and run with it?
I think there's definitely a shift of mindset happening, which is really exciting. In the middle of lockdown, we had a wonderful farmer called James Baird who rang us up and he'd read Wilding. And he said, in the book, you say that one day your dream is to connect with the sea 25 miles away to the south of us. And he said, I am that connection. I have the farm at Climping Gap, which is about the only piece of land that hasn't been built on between Brighton and Bognor. And he said, let's make a corridor between my land and you. And already we've signed a memorandum of understanding with numerous landowners and farmers between us to help create corridors and stepping stones to nature to reach NEP.
There'll be lots of people listening who will be thinking, well, I'd love to do something like this, but I don't have a garden, let alone 100 acres or 1,000 acres.
Yes, so that really is why Charlie, my husband, and I have produced a book called The Practical Guide to Rewilding Big and Small, because we feel that rewilding is for everybody, is a spectrum, and everyone is somewhere on it. If you can create a window box or even put a planter outside your door, you can bring nature back, producing plants that will be attracting night flying moths, for example. I mean, is such a joyful thing that it might lead you onto other things. But even if you have no land at all, you can pressure your local council to stop mowing the verges and create wildflower strips that lead into your urban parks. Rewild patches of your urban parks so they're actually productive habitat for birds and insects. And I think it's almost like the only way we can rid ourselves if we're feeling impotent in the face of all these huge problems that the planet is facing is to individually do something and connect with other people who are doing it too.
We promised another mezzo, and as we've come towards the end of the programme, she's going to sing us out, the late Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, wonderful singer who tragically died young. Why did you choose this?
It was actually my aunt Penelope Tree who introduced me to the voice of Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, and it's absolutely magical and consoling, and my husband Charlie now plays it all the time. But I like to think, I hope, that her voice in this is so relaxed that perhaps she had in a way come to terms with her imminent death. I hope that's what's true anyway.
Well, this is a sad but beautiful way to say goodbye, and thank you very much, Isabella Tree, as we listen to Schlummert ein, Bach's cantata, Slumber My Weary Eyes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Slumber My Weary Eyes, Bach's Cantata No. 82, sung by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the writer Isabella Tree. The programme was produced by Claire Walker.
BBC Radio 3 is the home of the BBC Proms. The world's greatest classical music festival begins. Expect a night of Nordic delights.
From Grieg's Piano Concerto to Sibelius's Finlandia.
And Britain's The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra.
Plus, a Ukrainian world premiere.
Georgia Mann and Petrok Trelawney bring you the music and the atmosphere live from the Royal Albert Hall. The first night of the Proms, on Friday night at 7. On BBC Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. It's 1 o'clock now. Time for the news, read by Tyler Dunn.
The Culture Secretary, Lucy Fraser, will meet the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davie, later today to discuss the allegations against one of the corporation's top presenters. Claims published in the Sun newspaper say the man paid a teenager tens of thousands of pounds for explicit images over 3 years, and the individual used the money to fund a crack cocaine habit. Their family says the BBC was informed of the allegations in May, but the star continued on air until recently. The BBC says it takes any allegations very seriously. President Biden will arrive in the UK this evening for talks with the Prime Minister and the King before travelling to the NATO summit on Tuesday. His visit comes at a time of tension between the US and its NATO allies over Washington's decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine. The US climate envoy John Kerry says Mr. Biden will also discuss global warming with Rishi Sunak. The US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the United States and China are moving towards a more healthy relationship. She was speaking at the end of her four-day trip to Beijing. Ms. Yellen described 10 hours of bilateral talks with the Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng as candid and constructive, but added disputes remained on issues such as Taiwan. The environmental group Just Stop Oil has said it doesn't know the woman who sprinkled orange confetti on the former Chancellor George Osborne at his wedding yesterday. The group retweeted a video of the moment with the message, "You look good in orange," raising speculation that it had been behind the incident. The French government has banned the sale, possession and transport of fireworks during the annual Bastille Day celebrations next weekend. In a decree, it said it was acting to prevent the risk of serious disturbances. Fireworks were used by protesters in the unrest that followed the killing of a teenager by police at the end of last month. And a collection of James Bond memorabilia that belonged to Sir Roger Moore is to be sold at auction in October. The lots include dinner suits made for him for A View to a Kill and Octopussy. The auctioneers, Bonhams, said the sale had been timed to coincide with the 50th anniversary year of Sir Roger's first appearance as 007. And the weather, rain clearing the southeast of England this afternoon, sunshine and showers elsewhere. Highs of 19 Celsius in Belfast, 21 in Cardiff and Edinburgh, and 22 in London. BBC News, it's now 2 minutes past one.
Tyler Dunn, thank you. Good afternoon from me, John Shea. Welcome to this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3 if you're just joining us. In an hour's time, this week's Early Music Show comes live from the York Early Music Festival. First, and in a change to the schedule published in some listings, another chance to hear a